From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, near-death experiences. Here's what's happening. Vitamin A nasal drops might be able to treat the loss or the altered sense of smell in some people who have had COVID, according to United Kingdom researchers. The University of East Anglia is conducting a 12-week trial. Only some of the volunteer patients will receive the treatment, but all will be asked to sniff powerful smells such as rotten eggs and roses. And brain scans will check if the vitamin has repaired injured pathways or smell nerves. That's an amazing story. YouTube is taking down several video channels associated with high-profile anti-vaccine activists, including Joseph Mercola and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who experts say are partially responsible for helping seed the skepticism that's contributed, they say, to slowing vaccination rates across the country. Let's check in with Howard Bloom, author of The Global Brain. Howard, what do you think of the censorship?
Well, this YouTube move pits two core American values against each other. It pits freedom of speech against saving human lives. Now, why the YouTube censorship? Just 12 people generate 65% of the anti-vaccine shares on YouTube, and anti-vaccine beliefs can kill you. As of today, 693,000 Americans have died of COVID. Almost all of those who died were unvaccinated. Meanwhile, Joseph Mercola, according to the New York Times, has published over 600 articles on Facebook that cast doubt on COVID-19 vaccines, but Mercola is not an unbiased source of information. He has earned over $100 million selling natural health remedies he says can allow you to take control of your health. Actually, YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook started to police COVID disinformation at the beginning of the pandemic a year and a half ago. Today, YouTube went beyond censorship of misinformation just on COVID vaccines to shutting down misinformation on all vaccines, including the claim that childhood vaccines cause autism. At bottom, this is something bigger than it seems. It is a battle of our entire society against the big lie. The idea of the big lie was invented by Adolf Hitler in the 1920s and developed as a tool by Hitler's propaganda czar, Joseph Goebbels. The doctrine of the big lie says that if you invent a lie big enough, it will overwhelm your audience's critical faculties and will trigger belief, especially if you repeat it over and over again. An example of the big lie is the original social media posting well over a year ago claiming that Anthony Fauci was Bill Gates' roommate at Cornell. Then, said the posting, Fauci became the first CEO of Moderna, one of the drug companies making a COVID vaccine. The posting implied that Fauci stands to make millions from the vaccines. But that's not all. Said the posting, it was at Cornell that Bill Gates designed the RFID, radio frequency identification chip, and patented it under US 20062578-52. And the posting claimed Bill Gates is using the COVID vaccine to implant his RFID microchips in you. There was only one problem. None of these facts were true. Bill Gates did not go to Cornell. He went to Harvard. Bill Gates could not have been a roommate of Anthony Fauci. Anthony Fauci left undergraduate school in 1962. Gates dropped out of Harvard in 1975. The two men were 333 miles and over 13 years apart. What's more, Anthony Fauci never worked at Moderna. Moderna was not founded until 2010. By then, Dr. Fauci had been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases for 24 years. Topping it all off, the patent number the posting gave for Bill Gates' alleged RFID chip is not for RFID chips. It's a chemical patent that relates to nucleic acids and proteins from the SARS coronavirus. And the patent was not issued to Bill Gates. It was issued to Jens P. Gregersen and David Chien. In other words, this critical posting, on which a massive conspiracy movement has been based, was brilliantly written, but every claim it made was a lie. But hey, freedom of speech means freedom to lie, to be inaccurate, doesn't it? No, it means an obligation to give the closest approximation to truth you can muster. Lies can kill. Over 2,600 Americans died of COVID yesterday. A huge proportion of them believe that vaccines are filled with microchips. In other words, because of their beliefs, almost all of those who died yesterday were unvaccinated. So which virus really killed them, the microbe or the virus of the big lie?
But I got to tell you, Howard, there are a lot of people who have been vaccinated that are getting COVID. It's a very weird and strange situation indeed. And one of the biggest problems is this mixture of all this tainted information with real information that needs to be investigated is screwing all this up, too. It's a rough situation. Illinois has recorded its first human case of rabies since 1954. Now people are being urged to take precautions if they come into contact with bats. According to the Lake County Health Department, in mid-August, a man in his 80s in north suburban Lake County awoke to a bat on his neck. How would you like to wake up with that? The bat was captured and tested positive for rabies. The man was advised he needed to start post-exposure rabies treatment. He declined. 1 month later, the individual began experiencing symptoms consistent with rabies, including neck pain, a headache, difficulty controlling his arms, finger numbness, and difficulty speaking. The man eventually died. Divisions among congressional Democrats threatened to derail President Joe Biden's financial agenda as moderates voiced anger at the idea of delaying a $1 trillion infrastructure bill ahead of a crucial vote to avert a government shutdown on Friday. Walmart is looking to hire upwards of 150,000 U.S. store associates to help meet the surge in demand during and after the holiday season. 150,000. Pending home sales snapped back in August, following 2 months of declines as the housing market showed signs of regaining its footing. Let's check in with registered investment advisor, as I will say, the birthday boy, Mitch Shedlock. Mitch, happy birthday.
Hey, thanks, George. Here I am. I'm in Ouray, Colorado right now, near Telluride. The fall colors here, George, are phenomenal. So having a great time here on my birthday, so thank you for that. Pending home sales up 8.1% versus 1% expected. That's a huge, huge, huge number, George. And these contract signings, they lead sales by about 45 to 60 days. So in the September and October reports, remember these reports lag by about a month, we're going to see a big surge in home sales. NAR's spokesperson Lawrence Young said that moderating prices are behind these sales. George, I don't get it. The Case-Shiller report came out last week. Home sales, home prices are up 19.7% year over year, a new all-time record for the series. Home prices are outstripping wages 3-1. And here's an interesting report. I don't know if you saw this today. Dollar Tree is going to break the buck, George.
It's going up past the buck.
They're no longer going to be able to sell stuff for a buck because of, well, transportation costs, other costs, all the costs are going up. So it's not going to be dollar anymore. They're going to go to a buck a quarter or a buck 50. Prices are rising, George.
All right, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your birthday. We'll talk to you next week. Does your mental health in your 20s determine your risk of dementia decades later? A new study finds happiness during young adulthood may be the best medicine for your brain during old age, according to researchers from the University of California, San Francisco. They discovered a link between depression at young ages and cognitive decline as those people reach their senior years. How about that? Stay happy. And new research shows that the U.S. is deep into the digital age, with data showing that Americans check their phones 96 times a day. Can you believe that? That's once every 10 minutes, according to a global tech care company. Wow. Up next, William Sargent on Coast to Coast. We're going to be talking about how horseshoe crabs played a role with the COVID-19 vaccine and one of his other works, Terror by Error. William Sargent next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. We've got a fascinating program for you tonight. Now, was COVID-19 caused by accidents similar to those that occurred from 1617 to the present time? Think about that for a moment. William Sargent is a consultant for the Nova Science series and the author of 27-plus books about science and the environment, including Terror by Error, the COVID Chronicles, which was the first book to investigate whether COVID came from about because of a lab accident. Think about that. We'll talk about that. formerly director of the Baltimore Aquarium and a research assistant at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He has taught at the Briarwood Center for Marine Biology and at Harvard University. His latest work, the second edition of Crab Wars, which we'll talk about as well. William, welcome to the program. I love your work, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
This is fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about Terror by Air. I said back in December of 2019 that I believed that the COVID-19 came from that Wuhan viral lab. Could not say whether it was accidental or intentional, but I was pretty sure that it came from that lab. I think I'm being vindicated now. What do you think?
I think we're both being vindicated. I was actually right at the same time. I was working on a book that was looking at biological warfare in this country and how that was what we were doing was weaponizing ticks. So, for instance, there was an instance where a young CIA recruit was told to just, appear at a very small airport. And they didn't tell him, you know, what he was going to do, but he was told to get on the plane. They flew out at night over the Caribbean, and when they got out over Cuba, this was during the Cuban Missile Crisis, they told him, okay, now open up the box in front of you. And he opened it up, and he looked in, and it was teeming with hundreds and thousands of ticks. And what we had done is we had put various pathogens in the ticks. And so they told him to throw it out the door, and he threw it out the door. And they returned back to their base. And a couple weeks later, his son got very, very sick. He spiked 105-degree temperature. And he went to his commanding officer, and he said, was there anything that would connect what we were doing that night with my son getting sick? And the commanding officer said, I can't give you any details. All I can tell you is burn all the clothes that you were wearing that night.
Wow.
So basically what we were doing, a lot of this research was being done on the East Coast near Long Island Sound at a place called the Plum Island Animal Research Institute. Mm-hmm. And that's where they were injecting some of these microbes into the ticks. And, you know, we have a lot of hurricanes on the East Coast. And during one of the hurricanes, the electricity shut down, the security went down. You have to have electricity to keep the microbes in. You have a negative air pressure that keeps everything in the biocontainment facilities. And the ticks got out, and then they were picked up by shorebirds. And these were migrating shorebirds, and they delivered them up and down the East Coast, giving us diseases like Lyme disease and babesiosis and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, a whole bunch of things like that. So anyway, I was finishing this manuscript, and all of a sudden I read in the New York Times that there was this new disease that people were finding in Wuhan, China. And as soon as I found out that Wuhan had the only what's called a level 4 biocontainment facility, I said, wow, that's yep. Probably the same story. And I haven't seen anything that's convinced me otherwise.
Well, you were right, too. And I mean, I'm still not convinced whether it was accidental or intentional. But what about the rumors that we've heard that we helped fund that lab to the tune of several million dollars?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. They were but essentially what we did is we were outsourcing this research. What they were doing is what's called gain of function research. And what you do is you take the virus and you inject it into a ferret, which is a small weasel like animal.
Yep.
And the virus mutates. You take it out of the ferret and you put it into another ferret, and it mutates some more. You take it out and you put it into another. And after so many ferrets, the virus can jump from ferret to ferret, which means it can also jump from human to human. So it's gained the function of transmissibility. In other words, it's contagious.
Why in God's name, William, would they even want to concoct something like this?
Well, what they it was sort of the standard way to figure out what vaccine to produce every year, because they have to figure out a year in advance how the virus is going to mutate, so they know, you know, how to engineer the vaccine. So this was the standard way they did it. We stopped doing it in this country because we felt that it was too risky. So we put a ban on it, but we continue to fund it in China. And, you know, when this first came out, everybody, you know, was considering it a conspiracy theory. It's actually the very opposite of a conspiracy theory, because a conspiracy theory, you have to have someone that knows what's happening is manipulating
right. Things.
I think this was just a simple mistake. You know, the ferret sneezed or it wiggled and the guy injected himself in the finger.
He got infected. Yeah.
And then he would have been patient number zero that then infected the other 44 patients in the hospital where he was sent.
Why did they come up with that excuse that this was concocted in a Wuhan market from a bat that somebody, you know, cooked up and ate?
Well, they were looking, and this is sort of what you would normally do. They were looking at the last disease, which was SARS, and that had come through a wet seafood market.
Uh-huh.
The two reigning theories now are one that it came from nature, so it's what are called a zoonotic disease. In other words, it starts from something like a bat, which is the reservoir species. Then it has to pass to what's called an amplifier species. So that's often a bird or a pig, so that you have an avian flu or a swine flu.
Well, that was a disaster, too, when the swine flu came out.
Absolutely. So that would be your first assumption. There are about 87 zoonotic diseases that have been identified. So that's what everybody sort of assumed that it's what probably happened. But then you started looking at all the circumstantial evidence that here you had a disease right outside the laboratory where they were doing this very risky research on the virus. The only other place where you were finding anything similar to that, they knew it came from bats, but the bats came from 1,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So if this were on the East Coast, it would be like having, you know, a little laboratory in Boston. All of a sudden you have a disease appear there, and the only other place that you have it would be down in Florida. I'm not familiar enough with the West Coast to be able. It would probably be the difference between Oregon and Southern California, where you would have the disease as opposed to where the lab was.
William, my other guest, who is in our news segment, thinks that Anthony Fauci is a national treasure. I kind of think otherwise. How about you?
I think both things are true.
Really?
He's kind of a personal hero of mine. I mean, he's done some fabulous work with AIDS, and he's been in public health for for decades.
I think he knows more than he's telling us.
Well, I think where he's his big failing is that he's been trying to say that we haven't been funding gain of function research.
Right.
And it's absolutely certain that we have. I mean, it's written up in all kinds of proposals and papers and everything like that. I think when he talks about it, he often is a little bit cagey with his words. So he'll say, well, we haven't been funding gain of function research in that laboratory. But it turns out there are some military laboratories. So I think he's sort of parsing his words there.
Or you give the money to some entity that gives it to that laboratory.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we've been doing. We've been funding an organization that's based in New York called EcoHealth, and they are the people who have been, transferring the money to do the gain-of-function research.
William, hold on. I want to get into your second edition of Crab Wars. This is an amazing story. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, say goodbye to September. Friday, it's October 1st already. Can you believe that? Wow. We'll be telling you what's in store for the rest of the year in another week or two, to be sure. We're going to take calls next hour with William Sargent as we talk about his thoughts on COVID-19 and Crab Wars, which we're going to get into in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, William Sargent with us. William, you have a book called Crab Wars, second edition, and you have been fascinated with horseshoe crabs since you were a kid, haven't you?
Absolutely. And George, I have to tell you, I feel like I'm in Los Angeles now. I live in a little town called Ipswich, and Hollywood has found us. They've made about 5 or 6 films in our little town in the last couple years. They're making a Steven Spielberg film this week. And our whole town looks like a little tiny town in Maine. And soon there's going to be vampires walking up and down the street.
I love it. Now, tell me about your interest in horseshoe crabs and this incredible relationship it has with COVID.
Yes. I grew up as a kid on Cape Cod in the summers, and I was always fascinated with horseshoe crabs. They're an incredibly primitive-looking animal. They look like something that Steven Spielberg might have invented for, carrying his stormtroopers around.
Right.
They look like a helmet or a little tank, and you see them crawling along the bottom.
With a tail, right?
Sorry?
They've got like a little tail or something.
And they have a little tail. If you grew up on the Cape or almost anywhere on the East Coast, you thought that tail was some kind of a stinger. But in fact, what they use that for is if they get flipped over on their back, they can be in trouble because birds can, peck at them and get to their gills and various things like that. So what they do is they arch their back up, and then they use that tail, and then they rock back and forth and back and forth until they finally can flip themselves back over.
It's crazy what Mother Nature comes up with, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That is so. Now, at what point did the horseshoe crab become part of COVID-19?
Well, we have to back up a little bit. There are two things that are of interest about horseshoe crabs. One are their eyes. They have about 9 eyes in all. And there was a Dr. H. Keffer Hartline who won the Nobel Prize in 1967 for his research on the optic nerve of the horseshoe crab that runs from their 2 compound eyes to their brain. And their brain lies in a circle around their mouths. So these guys actually eat through their brains. I don't know if you do that. I do that about 3 times a day. But the other thing that's of interest about horseshoe crabs is their blood. They have a bright blue copper-based blood, unlike human blood, of course, which is iron-based and red. This is a beautiful cobalt blue. And anything that's going to come in contact with the human blood system, whether it's a syringe, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's an antibody test, all of these things, also pacemakers, all have to be tested to make sure that they're free of what are called gram-negative bacteria.
Huh.
And the way they do that now is with the horseshoe crab blood.
Is the blood like show it or something?
Exactly. What they do is they bleed the crab, and what they do is they hold them in these wooden racks, and then they put a needle, it's the same size needle that a vet would use on a horse, and they put it into the hinge between the shells, and then you get a free flow of blood, and once the blood stops flowing, then they stop the bleeding process. And then what they do is they spin out the blood and they freeze dry it so that you have a white powder. And then when you're going to test something, you reconstitute that with water. And what happens is that if you mix it in with something that has gram-negative bacteria, say you're testing a vaccine, then it will turn a bright blue. So it does the same thing that it does when you bleed a crab. And that's simply the test. Then you know that it's contaminated with gram-negative bacteria.
Is this what is called the lysate test?
Lysate is the other word for it. What you do is you lyse the cells. So essentially, if you put them in fresh water, they break open. That's also where we get the term Lysol, I believe.
Now, there's a shortage of the horseshoe crabs now, isn't there?
Yes, and what's it shows how fragile our medical system is, because this is a very, very common procedure. It's almost as common as taking your temperature or you're taking your blood pressure. So it happens thousands and thousands of times every day, anywhere from small clinics, third world hospitals, to major pharmaceutical firms. And it's all based on this single species of wild animal, and that animal is declining up and down the East Coast. You only get them on the East Coast in this country from Maine all the way down to the Yucatan Peninsula. And you get the biggest ones and the most crabs in the Delaware Bay area.
Is the blood expensive?
Yes. A quart of processed horseshoe crab blood is worth about $1,500.
Wow.
And also each individual crab, if you keep it alive, excuse me, and use it for lysate, then that crab is worth about $1,500.
Didn't you have an opportunity to invest in this years ago and you backed down?
I did. That's, I guess you could say that's one of the sad stories of my life. There was a Woods Hole scientist who was bleeding these crabs in his garage, and he wanted to start a company based on the blood of horseshoe crabs. And he asked me if I'd like to become a partner. And to become a partner, you had to raise about $5,000 to buy equipment. I had no idea how I could raise $5,000, and I thought it was a flaky idea, so I turned him down. He sold that company about 20 years ago to a Japanese firm for $32 million.
Oh, my God. Are you kicking yourself?
Sorry? Do I kick myself over that?
Yeah.
Not really. You know what? I was actually more interested in the story than I was in making money off the horseshoe crab.
It's a great story.
It's a fascinating story.
Now, what role does the horseshoe crab play in this battle against COVID now?
Well, so all of the vaccines that we're taking and all the antibody tests have to be tested to make sure that they're free of gram-negative bacteria. And the way they do that now is with the horseshoe crab test. We found out about the horseshoe crab test. It was approved by the FDA in 1976 when we had the swine flu scare. And what happened is that a recruit at Fort Dix, New Jersey, went out on maneuvers, and he came back, and he got a very serious flu. And everybody thought that was a return of the swine flu that we had in 1918, the so-called Spanish flu. And so President Ford decided that he would immunize every man, woman, and child in the United States, and it was a big public thing. And what happened is that the flu never infected anybody other than this one recruit. But what happened is that the people who got the vaccines came down with all kinds of very serious neurological problems. And it was because the vaccines were contaminated with bacteria. And the old way they used to test for gram-negative bacteria is all the pharmaceutical companies would have large colonies of live rabbits. So they might have 600 or 700 live rabbits. And what they would do is they would take the vaccine and inject it into a rabbit. And if the rabbit kicked over and died, then you knew that the vaccine was contaminated. So when this all started happening, they started using the horseshoe crab blood test. And they found out that it was easier to use, it was much more sensitive, and it was cheaper. So they then made that the official test for gram-negative bacteria.
There is a syndrome called Guillain-Barré, isn't it? It's a syndrome. Does that affect because of the flu immunizations? I had a doctor who came down with this thing.
Yeah, that was a problem during the swine, as they called it, the swine flu fiasco.
That was part of the end result, I guess,
exactly,
this disease.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, what about a synthetic version of this lysate?
Well, this is that's a really good question, and there's a scientist in Singapore who has used gene splicing to come up with a synthetic version of the lysate. And part of the reason that she did that is that people who were interested in endangered birds were concerned because the birds are dependent on horseshoe crab eggs. So you have birds like red knots that migrate from Tierra del Fuego on the tip of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle, and they time their migration so that they're on the Delaware beaches when the horseshoe crabs are laying their eggs. And then they'll eat 40 tons of horseshoe crab eggs, and then that gives them the fuel to make the next leg of their migration up to the Arctic Circle. So she developed this synthetic form of lysate, and so you won't have to use the horseshoe crabs. But the Food and Drug Administration hasn't approved that yet. And the reason for that is they didn't want to, you know, switch horses in midstream in the middle of the pandemic. So we have about 30 years of data where using the natural lysate, and we know that it works very, very well. We only have about 2 years worth of trials with the synthetic form, and it's still true that the natural form is more sensitive and less expensive and easier to use. So I think eventually it's going to be accepted by the Food and Drug Administration. And when that happens, you know, the lysate industry will come to a rapid end. You'll stop having the fisheries for the horseshoe crabs, and the horseshoe crabs will have about a million years to recover. I think, you know, if I were Jimmy the Greek, I think I would put my money on horseshoe crabs recovering rather than humans recovering
right
in the next million years.
Do you think the vaccines that came out from the three companies, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and Moderna, came out way too fast? It was strange to me how quickly they were able to come up with this.
Well, I think it's fortunate for us that they did come out quickly. A lot of that, it is a new technology. They were doing this messenger RNA. It was the basis for their vaccines, we got help from the Chinese scientists who gave us the sequence, and we were able to do it literally almost over a weekend.
Right, it was rapid fire.
It was a combination of a very good science and luck.
Or were they already ready for it, William?
Yes, in a sense they were. I mean, they had the basic platform, and all they needed was the sequence, so they could make the actual vaccine.
We're going to take calls with William Sargent next hour as we talk about his works, Terror by Error, Crab Wars, which is the second edition. First edition came out after 9/11, didn't it?
That's right, yes. Yep. And the original title for the first book was Horseshoe Crabs, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Bioterrorism, and Human Health, because I did write it right after 9/11. And, when I was writing it, I was sort of questioning myself, saying, what am I doing writing about horseshoe crabs? you know, when thousands of people have just died in the World Trade Center. And I went back and I looked, you know, at a wonderful California writer, John Steinbeck, and he had written, I think, my favorite book. He wrote The Log from the Sea of the Log from the Voyage to the Sea of Cortez, and he and Ed Ricketts, who was a very well-known marine biologist on the West Coast. And he was actually the basis for Doc in Cannery Row. But they rented this shrimp boat, and they traveled down around the Baja Peninsula collecting animals. And he was questioning, they were doing this during World War II, and he was questioning why were they concerned about the starfish and these little tide pools when, you know, people were dying in Europe and in Japan. And he decided that it was all important or none of it was important at all. And I felt the same way. You know, the horseshoe crab story is probably even more important because, you know, everybody listening to this show, lives have been protected by horseshoe crabs. Because whenever you get a vaccine, whenever you get any sort of a shot, whenever you get a pacemaker, they all have to be tested with the horseshoe crab test.
Because if you get this bacteria, you're toast, aren't you?
Exactly. Yeah, you go into shock.
Where do we get your books, William?
You can get them through my site, which is williamsargent.net. You can get them through the University of Chicago Press as well.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment and take phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM.